NHS is one of those institutions that practically everyone, well, in the UK anyway, will have come into contact with in one way or another in their lives. We might read the headlines, listen to political speeches, or hear about our friends and family's experiences. But what is it actually like to work and lead in the NHS, particularly in the current climate? I'm Lee Griffith, a leadership strategy coach, and in the Leaders with Impact podcast, I'm proving it's possible to succeed without following outdated rules and old school stereotypes. I'm here to help you get clear on your personal strategy, implement some self-leadership, and connect with those you serve through your communications so that you can deliver improved organisational performance, engagement, and reputation. If you want more leadership insights, sign up to my monthly newsletter at sundayskies.com. Today's episode's a good one. I had the pleasure of chatting with David Melia, Chief Nursing Officer at Liverpool University Hospital NHS Foundation Trust. We talk a lot about bringing your whole self into your role, and David's personality and enthusiasm shows how you can do that with humility, reflection, and understanding of others. We discuss that transition from specialist to organisational all-rounder, what it's like working with a board, how you improve the staff and patient experience, tackling the big challenges, and encouraging diversity. I hope you enjoy. Lovely to welcome you, David, to the Leaders with Impact podcast. Thank you for joining us. The whole premise of the podcast is to explore what impactful leadership looks like. So I want to start with a really open question and define for you to define really what impactful leadership looks and feels like for you.
Okay. So first of all, thank you for inviting me on. Really excited. Impactful leadership. Gosh, there are so many different ways to look at this, aren't there? And I think that one of the main ways that perhaps I will talk about throughout this, because I've obviously prepared my own thoughts, is around how you inspire, how one inspires other people. And I can't get over past this whole thing of being your authentic self, which I think is really, really important. But actually, my authentic self might be rotten. It might really, really turn people off. And so, you know, I'm sure that never happens. But how do I, as my authentic self, understand how I make an impact on people? And do I actually bring them along on a journey, inspire them to lead on that journey so I follow them? Do I give the opportunity for people to take accountability for themselves, their actions and their services and their lives? Does my impact have a contraindicator to that and people act differently? And so I look at impactful leadership in a very positive light, but you have a personal responsibility to understand how you have that impact on other people.
Yeah, I think then you've hit on a really important point, because that sense of authenticity, and I often talk about being an authentic leader, if you're a really poor person and that's just who you are, I'm not necessarily encouraging that.
Or you just have a kink in your personality or a particular experience. And we all have experience in our lives that have shaped us as individuals, but also shaped us as the leaders we are or the people we are within organizations. And I think that if we don't reflect on how that has made us the way we are and how we act and how we relate or not to other people, we're missing out on a great opportunity, not just to be effective, but we're missing out on that whole opportunity of connecting with people and learning.
So throwing your point back to you, I suppose, what's shaped you in terms of getting you to the point that you're at now?
So, I mean, gosh, I think that when I've been a nurse now, this is my 40th year of being a nurse. And so I've had lots and lots of different experiences. And of course, over time, the culture in which I've worked has been very, very different. I started off as a training to be a nurse and became a nurse for people with learning disabilities in the early 1980s, and worked in what would have been a an asylum, an institution. And so the behaviours there that I encountered looking back were horrific. You know, I know we can't always look back with modern eyes on past times, but even then it wasn't good and it wasn't kind. But throughout all of that, I worked with some people who had the absolute bottom line of what they would not go below in the way in which they dealt with people or how they provided care or how they maintained not just the patient's dignity, but their own dignity in what could have been quite a challenging situation. And so I think throughout the whole of my career, I've worked with people or have encountered people or I've worked with patients who have actually given me some essence of who I am now and also who I don't want to be. And I have two people who always spring to mind, and it was not long after I first started my first nurse training, around somebody who still inspires me today about how to treat people and how to recognize people who are trying their best and who have made a success without being utterly gushy about it, but actually being really sincere in thanking and acknowledging. And then somebody who was such a challenge person individually themselves, that the way in which they led was by being unpleasant and being a bully, basically, and was allowed to get away with that because the organization didn't challenge and it was a different time. But everybody knew what an unpleasant person this ward manager was. And I always had this, and I'm not going to say the name, but I always have this in my head around, if I ever got to a point where I thought I was displaying any of those behaviors or traits or even those thoughts, that's the bit that's going to make me think, actually, is this the right, am I in the right place? Either am I in the right job or am I in the right place in my life or any of those? And then, of course, there are other outside influences, aren't there, what happens in our lives. You know, we can't and we shouldn't. We should try and separate our own life experiences from how we act in work. And I think that's all about bringing your best self to work, whether that's authentic, however we describe it, around acknowledging that the experiences that we have as an individual will shape us no matter where we are. And to try and mask that or pretend it didn't happen, or you're not dealing with something, or you've not celebrated something, or you've not been hurt by something, I think leaves an emptiness in who you are as a person, and also therefore an emptiness as who you are as a leader.
Yeah. Wow, there is a lot here that I want to unpack, and some Absolutely. Of it we're definitely going to come to later on in the discussion. Taking you right back, so you've been in nursing for 40 years. Was that
40 years this year? Yeah.
Did you as a kid, never. I want to be a nurse?
Never in a million years. So I grew up in Liverpool. My father died suddenly when I was 14. I'm the youngest of three children, and my mum was left as a widow when she was relative. Well, she was a young woman. And the plan for me was, I was 14 when Dad died. My plan for me was I was going to finish in school and then I was going to do my A-levels. And it was the early 80s. And, you know, if people of a certain vintage will remember what it was like then, it was horrific. You know, there was job shortages. There was the recession and all those sorts of things. And so the plan was either, David, you get a job, or you use your A-levels and go to university. And so I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew what I wanted to do, but mum wouldn't let me because it involved really just having a good time and doing what a teenager would want to do, you know, go out and stay out and work in a pub. And that really wasn't probably the best idea. And so as part of my A-levels, we were allowed to do an afternoon, a week, doing voluntary work. And I went and worked with MenCap. And I chose MenCap because the centre or the place I was going to be doing the voluntary work was easy to get to. It was something that I'd never done before. And I thought, oh, that would be interesting. And I went and I really, really enjoyed myself. And I really thought this is going to be really great. And again, looking back, it was very sort of old-fashioned, even old-fashioned for the times, but it was an opportunity for people who had a learning disability to mix with their peers and to try and do some of the activities that you would do. And we played records and we just tried to have, but it was a false environment. It was in a church hall, but it was the best that I guess was happening at the time. And one of the workers said to me, gosh, you're good at this. Have you thought about doing it as a career? And I said, well, I'm going to plan to go to university because I want to get a qualification. And they said, oh, you can become a nurse for people with learning disabilities. No, I'd never, there was nobody in my family who was a nurse or in any of those services. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. And then there was an advert in the Liverpool Echo a couple of weeks later for a hospital just outside the East End of London who were advertising for student nurses. And I saw it and I applied and I had a small interview in Liverpool. And then I passed that and I had to go down to London or outside of London to have the proper interview. And of course, I didn't think I was going to get it. So I didn't bother telling my mum that I'd applied. And 4 days later, I told her I was staying at a friend's house overnight. So there you go. And so I got a letter to say that I was going to be starting my training in that September. And then I had to break it to my mum that I was going to become a nurse and I was going to be moving down south. Not going to university because it wasn't a university program then. And so I, my mum sort of just, well, she was just wide-eyed with astonishment of a nurse. And she basically said, well, you know, I'll give you 3 months. If you don't like it, come back. We'll find you a job and then you'll go to university the year after. And of course, I went, I loved it. And the rest is history. So short answer, no expectations that I would ever be a nurse. As soon as I started my training, I recognized that whole aspect of being with people, either as caring role or that professional role, but also with colleagues and that atmosphere working in an organization, a big organization, and the experiences that you have, the absolute privilege of those experiences was something that I thought, oh my goodness, I'm at home here. And it just led on to lots of different opportunities. Now, I don't think I've ever looked back and thought, oh, gosh, I wish I had gone and done sociology as a degree. Nothing against people who do sociology as a degree in the early 80s, but I don't know where I would have ended up. I'm sure I'd have been very happy. But my life has been so rich for the fact that I have been a nurse.
So you're now chief nurse in a hospital trust in Liverpool.
Yeah.
For those who don't know what that might entail, do you want to give a brief overview of what a chief nurse does?
Sure. So I work at a large university teaching hospital in Liverpool, and we have 3 hospital sites. We have 4 hospitals. We employ probably just over 15,000 members of staff, of which about a third are registered nurses, healthcare assistants, and allied health professionals. And so I'm the member of the trust board who is professionally accountable for their practice, but also have an executive responsibility for patient safety, patient experience, for safeguarding, for governance and the way in which we manage our governance processes, from that learning from incident, volunteers, chaplaincy. There's a whole raft of portfolios, and then some clinical services as well: infection prevention and control, tissue viability, smoking cessation, some end of life care. And so we have a whole portfolio. And so I'm the representative on the board that gives advice and assurance on safe practice, advice and guidance on how we should conduct ourselves as a board for making decisions when it comes to those patients' safety and experience concerns or issues, but also to put that quality angle when we're talking about making discussions around how we use our resources. And so can reflect back into, would that potentially have a positive or negative impact on how safely we can provide care?
Again, there's loads in here that I want to pick up on, but I want to focus a little bit first on that transition into one of the things often with first time executives, you see that they've come up through a specialist route and then they get into this more generalist role where they're having to be more organizationally focused and everything. So I'm interested in what your experience has been as you've transitioned through more and more senior roles into one where you're not just representing your specialist area, but you're having to have an eye over everything.
So I guess I took the usual route of becoming I did my general nurse training after my learning disability training. And then I stayed in that. I felt really comfortable and the opportunities were great. And I did that usual route of becoming a ward manager. And then I went into a specialism and set a service up. And then I was given the opportunity to actually go back into a leadership role and become responsible for a whole group of wards and departments. And I did that. And was that something I chose to do? Probably not. I don't really think I've had a cogent forward plan for my career. What I've done is I've always tried to put myself into the best position of, just in case something comes along, oh, that may look interesting. But when I got into the leadership role and over wards and departments, I recognised that gave me a greater opportunity to not just support patients, but support people who were providing those services to have a greater voice in how those services were delivered and how they were going to be better supported as professionals. And then I got, opportunities. I was the deputy director of nursing, and then I had my first chief nurse role back in 2006. And that was a small organization and it was great and it was lovely, but I recognized that my experience there as a chief nurse would be very, very different to a peer in a larger organization. And so I think that was a great opportunity for me to have tested the waters of, was that something I was comfortable doing or at ease with the discomfort of doing, but also competent to be able to make decisions and to work within that collaborative approach of an executive team. I think I did have that security of, because it was a specialist trust, I was able to rely on my specialist clinical knowledge to help guide me through some of those trickier decisions. And then it was just opportunities and circumstance. I did a sideways move to become a deputy director of nursing in a large teaching hospital. So I got that wider experience. Again, not with the expectations that I was always going to go on to that senior leadership role, because I was still considering, do I go into a senior clinical route? But opportunities just came up. And I guess the more I was becoming involved, and I gave myself an opportunity to experience more than just what that was in my role. I would dabble or I'd get involved in particular projects more out of curiosity than anything. It led me to a point very often of, gosh, that's really interesting. I'm sure I could do that. Or wouldn't it be great to be one of the leaders there that could help shape doing something or making a difference? And we use making a difference quite a lot in nursing. And for me, it was, what would be the impact on the people who are providing that service to make them more effective and gain greater satisfaction of doing that job themselves? And we now know that there's all research around happier staff, more engaged staff, provide better patient care and better patient outcomes. But in essence, what I wanted to do is work with colleagues so that they enjoyed doing what they were doing, because ultimately it's a very difficult and challenging job, no matter who you are, whether you're clinical or non-clinical in the NHS, it's always going to be pressured. And I wanted to be part of an opportunity for people to feel as though their job perhaps enriched them in some way.
Yeah. What surprised you moving into a board role?
Not my current board, because I've worked on several boards, at people's behaviours.
Yeah.
And people's behaviours. And again, this certainly isn't my current organisation. I perhaps mention my current organisation or how I feel about working here later. I've witnessed some really interesting, and I use the word interesting advisedly, behaviours and ways in which people react to one another, whether it's around politics with a small p and schisms and cliques, whether it's around the absolute profound knowledge that some people have who may be a non-executive around a particular issue. And you think, my goodness, you know, how amazing is that that they can, that you know, that they have really taken the time to hurt themselves so that they can make the best participation. And then others that perhaps haven't, and they will lead down a rabbit hole or a particular hobby horse on any opportunity. And so that's been one of the, so other people, but it's also been my own, how I felt when I've thought I am feeling vulnerable in those situations, particularly if it's to deliver difficult or controversial news or result to the trust board. How does that make me feel as an individual taking responsibility for that, where I may be sharing a message that wasn't my fault, but you can't, you know, one, I'm in a position of responsibility and I can't just say, oh, it's not my fault, but I have to take an accountability for myself and my own leadership around, so why are we in a position? And so sometimes understanding more around my own vulnerability has been that profound learning at Trust Board, and what is it that makes me either feel uncomfortable or has made me feel uncomfortable. So yeah, it's looking at my own learning from situations that might not have felt so great initially, but you know, looking back and perhaps how I've dealt with things in different ways, I do like to reflect. I don't do sort of formal reflection as an exercise. I don't sort of write a journal. I do write things for memory, but actually I do a lot of personal reflection on my day or my week or whatever when I'm doing non-work activities. And I think that sort of exercise is really, really important, because that's the only way that I personally am going to learn, and then reflecting some of that back to other colleagues.
The point you've raised about vulnerability is so interlinked in some ways to the behavior point that you made, because that's all about how safe you feel to share those vulnerabilities and to air the things that need to be aired. And if you don't have the right conditions around that board table that allows that safety and allows you to be vulnerable, then that's when the issues occur, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I wondered whether, because we touched on earlier, you had this example of an inspiring leader and then a ward manager whose behaviours were appalling, and you know, that isn't what you wanted. You've obviously encountered people at board level that perhaps haven't had the behaviours and or demonstrated values that you would agree with. How do you think that, because it's, you know, this isn't isolated. I hear this from a lot of people that work in health service. I've worked in the health service myself, so I've experienced that firsthand, and I have friends and family as well who've, and it does feel like it's a constant challenge that seems to be cropping up. Obviously, there are many exceptions and variabilities across the country, but what can be done about that? I'm going off topic a little bit, but it's an interesting one.
Not at all. I think it's how, I mean, I think we're, most organisations are either looking for how are we going to create a pipeline, a recruitment, or a future state of succession for all sorts of roles. So if we're thinking about board, you know, the executives and non-executives, but how are we going to prepare people for what may be their future career? And I think that's equally as important for non-executives, because they will come in, and the vast majority of people I work with as non-execs have been really, really inspiring. You know, they often hold really important important and very, very busy jobs, and yet they still have the desire to support the health system to be better than it is, and those sorts of issues. But I think it's becoming more difficult and challenged now because we're seeing more public being held to account, sort of accountability. And we're not preparing the future workforce as well as we can do. Was the pandemic something to do with that? Well, I think it was. A lot of things went on pause. But I think that we've got a responsibility within our own health systems, not just our own organisations, to look at so what are we doing to encourage current and future leaders to be as progressed as they can be? And I think that that's a challenge as well as everything else that's happening in the NHS. But if we don't do something by yesterday, we are going to be in a really, really parlous state, because a lot of leaders that I know are of a certain age. You know, I'm 58 this year, and don't deny that I look it. I'm 58, and you know, I'm not intending to retire just at the moment, but I know that in the next few years that'll be probably what I'll do. And the job that I'm in now isn't a first job for a chief nurse. This is a job for someone who has had an experience and a bit more of a seasoned experience and career. And we need to be supporting people now as a profession. And that's not just in nursing, that's in all roles on boards. And I really don't think that we as a NHS have really taken that on board properly. I think we pay lip service sometimes and we put people on a program, but that program is often in-house.
Yeah.
Really try to do it really nicely and well, but actually the way in which you get that experience is by having contact and networks outside of your own organization. Yeah. And that it's not just friends, it's not just buddies, it is people who will challenge you respectfully, but will challenge you about your aspiration or your position or your decision making or how you would react to a particular set of circumstances.
I need to hire you as my marketing person. That's
well, we can discuss that. It's normally biscuits, you know, Alki.
So you've touched on the fact that you represent a third of the workforce in your organisation, but your accountability is much wider than that, from a quality patient care point of view and from an organisational responsibility as well. How do you make the two things work with each other and not against each other?
So I think that the most valuable thing that I do is to really prioritise visibility. And so that visibility can take all different forms. So obviously people can't see me today, but I'm in uniform today. I wouldn't normally wear uniform. But what I try and do is two or three mornings a week, I will be on one of our hospital sites and I'll meet the staff who are coming in for the beginning of their shift. So I'll be there for 6:30 and I'll do that till 8 o'clock in the morning. And of course, you're meeting members of staff, whether it's nurses or administrative staff, consultants, porters, whoever are coming in, as well as members of the public. And first of all, people, and I started this in the pandemic because it was an easy way to contact and be in contact with staff. But what I found was just having that, not running around trying to do a hello, how are you, but actually just standing still in a prominent area and giving people eye contact as they come into work and say, morning, how are you doing? Hope you have a good shift. I hope you have a good day. People are a little bit, not stunned, a little bit unsure at first, but you become a fixed feature. Mm-hmm. And then people will come up and talk to you. And so I think I learn a lot more doing things like that, where I am being consciously still and observing, than I would if I were to do a formal round or whatever. And I don't really particularly like those that formality of, I think it just puts people's backs up, and I don't really think it's as useful as it could be. But actually, what I really thought would happen was I would just be inundated with people coming up and telling me what was wrong about our organization, or how I was treated badly or whatever. And I have to say 90-95% of people come up and tell me something positive, because they don't think that I know that it's happened, whether it's in their department or on their ward or whatever. And it could be something monumental, or it could be something that they consider as being trivial, but actually makes a difference. How they prepare for meal times for patients. And they just want to let you know because they're proud of it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I will, you know, we all have our phones with us and I'll write, well, I'll just jot that down. Because when I do go out onto the clinical areas, I'll make a point of going and seeing Rachel on ward 12T and just going on, oh, you're here, you've done something really great around mealtimes. I've come just before lunchtime just to sort of see what it is, because this sounds really, really exciting. And that's where I get my greatest learning. Yes, we do lots of improvement work. Yes, we have lots of data and outcomes. But I think being able to triangulate all of that with what you're seeing and actually how it feels, because we can do improvement work, but if it doesn't feel good for the people who are doing the work, or it doesn't feel good for those people who are receiving care, we're hitting the target but missing the mark. Absolutely.
I love that phrase. I'm going to steal that with pride. Consciously steal. That's
you know, so there's it was something that I did many, many years ago, and I think it was, I'll probably miss, but I'm sure it was a Royal College of Nursing toolkit, and it was called Observations of Care. And so if you go into a busy area, say an outpatient's clinic, and you just take a seat and you just sit quietly and watch the interactions. So you'll have a member of staff who may walk through, and are they looking at that person who's in the chair who look really anxious because they're going to be going in for some results? Do people get eye contact from people as they're walking? Because all that people really want to have is an acknowledgement that people know that they're there. Because if they get that acknowledgement, they feel safe. They feel as though, yes, my presence here is important. And then when there's a delay or a people, they don't feel as though they've been lost. Mm-hmm. So that whole issue of being conscious of your own presence and your own impact is really important. And so it's really great to be able to sit back and watch how other people do it, because we can learn how we treat our patients and the people who use our services, but also why sometimes staff don't do that because of the way in which either they're being led or the organization dumps a load of pressure on them that is unnecessary, or a whole batch of data requests, or fill this form in and do this because it's the nurse can do it because, oh, they, you know, because there's so many of them, or whatever that might be. And it's that learning, and it's a really, really powerful tool just to observe, not comment, not go and try and fix things, but just to watch.
I can see behind you. Is it Fun Boy Free and Bananarama? It ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. That's what gets results. I love that. I mean, that just sums up the conversation.
I will be crucified for this. We had some really great news about our patient experience, our staff experience survey recently. And there's a lot of us that the executive team is relatively new. And so this was the first year's results that really had an impact because it had an impact.
You were the most improved trust, weren't you, in the country?
We are indeed, yes, on all measures. And so, you know, that took us from being lowest of the low to adequate, which is not where we want to be. But actually, in a year, it was. So we were discussing at Trust Board around, so how did it happen? So we were talking about the improvement plan. We were talking about the processes we do, the way in which we measure, and we would, you know, all that really, really important stuff. And then I was asked for a comment, and I said, I think it's our method of how we have delivered the improvements. And I'd like to make a quote. And the quote I would like to make is Bananarama. It ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. And of course, I did it as a joke, but to make a point. And I was told that somebody had been on a trust board for 32 years and Bananarama had never been quoted to them before. But actually, it is the way that you do it. Yeah. And so one of my colleagues sent me that as a jokey reminder.
Yeah, but it's a nice, you know, we can have all these plans and these whizzy strategies and we can make it sound really intellectual, but it comes down to kind of human-to-human behaviour.
Absolutely. So, you know, I have worked in an organisation where we had this, we had a discussion about the 5 and 10 foot rule. So if you're walking down a corridor and you are 10 foot away from somebody, you smile at them. And if you're 5 foot away, this was some time ago, 5 foot away, you'd go, good morning. You know, how intimidating. So, you know, it was so false. Intent was good, but it was so false and felt uncomfortable, you know. But again, part of it, I've taken away is you've got to understand how people look at you as a leader as you're walking down that corridor. And if I'm marching off to buy a sandwich from a lunch somewhere and I'm sort of like going over 3 meetings that I've got this afternoon and crikey, have I prepared for that? And that's going to be and people are walking past and I'm not acknowledging people. They're either going to think, oh, he's moody or he's not approachable. Mm-hmm. And neither of those, I would want people to have that impression of me. Sometimes I am moody, but that shouldn't be reflected on how I work or treat or react with staff. I need to deal with that in a different way. And so, you know, you're very much on show, I guess. But yeah, and so, yeah, so we don't have a 5 and 10 foot rule here.
That's good. So can we touch a little bit on the challenges? So obviously there's been a lot in the media recently around public satisfaction in the NHS. We know morale is an issue that across the board. Things have been incredibly relentless pre-pandemic, but has continued to you know, ever since. And then there's this narrative nationally around the drive to do more with less, focus on improving quality, moving care out of hospital settings, whatever it might be. So there's this constant challenge and change in the way that the NHS should be working. How does it feel to be leading in the midst of that?
On my best day, it's really exciting because actually I work in a system where our health and social partners are really, really want to collaborate and to work on different models and different approaches. And so there is an opportunity for us to be as creative as possible. I work with some amazing people within my own organization who are really sparky and why don't we do or whatever, you know, really great and picking up the best practice from other areas. On my less than best day, it can sometimes feel overwhelming of not another. And whether that's partly because of I've been round the block a few times now and you do see some of the things, initiatives come back again, perhaps with a different badge or a different logo, or be a thing, yeah, we've done that before. And I never want to be that person who says, oh, we did that before and it never worked, because perhaps things just were at the wrong time and that's why it didn't work. Perhaps we didn't give it the greatest emphasis or the different care in how we implemented, or we didn't support our people to be the best that they could be. But there's a, you're right about the morale across my profession nationally, is that, you know, people still feel exhausted and all they can see is through to the end of the shift. In the main, obviously that's not everybody, but I'm still heartened by, even though people are working incredibly hard in very, very difficult circumstances, the significant thing that comes back from them is we want it to be all right for our patients. We want it to be safe for our patients. How can we do it differently? And yes, we'll all have a chunner or a this isn't right. We need more. We need difference. But actually, that recognition is still there around, well, we're not going to be able to move all these patients out of the hospital who should be in social care or receiving care in their own homes. And so that is going to have a delay within our patient flow. So what are we going to do to make it the best that it can be? Maintaining people's privacy and dignity and in the best of a difficult situation. And a lot of that comes from my colleagues who are working on the front line, as it should do, because they're the experts. They're the ones that are living it day in, day out. And so it does feel disheartening at sometimes. It feels overwhelming, but it does bring absolute golden rays of amazingness of the way in which some people take that challenge and really turn it into an opportunity. And I know that sounds cheesy, but some people I work with, that I just don't know where they get that creativity and that drive from. Mm-hmm. They're having done a really, really tough shift.
And how do you get, I suppose, the board buy-in and that alignment when you've perhaps got, I'm not saying this of your organisation specifically, yeah, but you've got a finance director that is really focused on the bottom line. You've got an operational director who's being pressured for the targets, for example. Mm. So everyone's got their own pressure from a different angle. How do you, what have you learned, I suppose, about getting that alignment?
I suppose it's about being mindful that without the partnership of working with the FD or the chief operating officer or whoever, without us working together, having a sound financial balance means nothing if there's such significant harm. Having amazing quality of care means nothing if we are absolutely bankrupt and we're all removed as execs and then the hospital goes into a mass cost improvement plan the year after and everybody leaves because it's boom or bust all the time. So there is an imperative for us all to understand what our own priorities are. One of the amazing things that I'm really delighted about the organization I work in, and this is led by our chief executive, is that we make a conscious decision that once a month, the executive team take some time together and we take a day. And that's a big commitment time-wise, but we take a day, we do some, what our shared goals are, we do what development do we need as a team, we do what are our priorities and how we're going to get to them. But actually, it will be David from a nursing and non-medical clinical position, where do you see, and then our FD will come in and we will all understand and we will come to a mutually agreed unitary board, isn't it, or a unitary approach. But we will do that and we'll, it's safe for us to have a bit of a discussion about, David, you're talking through your hat, because actually we can't do that at the moment. And I'll be going, yeah, but we've got a regulator who's really pushing for us. And how are we going to balance that regulatory aspect against the regulatory aspect around finance? And so it's how we work together around having that balance. An understanding of what our risk is. Mm-hmm. And so that's the approach that we take here around our discussions, and our approach is around what are we going to do to reduce that risk? And that risk can be a financial risk. It can be a patient harm risk.
Right.
And never are they just the one thing.
No. It's one of those, it's like a Jenga tower, isn't it?
Moving
pieces and trying not to let it fall down.
Yeah.
I'm conscious of our time, but I do have a couple of other areas that I want to touch on, if that's okay. So stalking is a bit of a strong word, but I've had a look at your social media and seen you've been talking about. And I can see that you're a great ally and champion for equity and inclusion.
Yeah.
And I suppose I want to understand a bit more around what, and I suppose particularly you being a male leader in a quite female dominated area, what your experiences and challenges have been and how you've had to tackle them in your career.
Yeah. So I think that one of the most important aspects of my job as a member of the board, not alone being the chief nurse, is around how do we ensure that there's fair and equitable access to opportunity for the whole of our workforce. And if I just look at our nursing and AHP workforce at the moment, we've done a significant and very successful recruitment of international recruitment drive. And it has been successful. It's been over a number of years. And we've had a really small attrition, tiny amount of attrition, because people feel welcomed and comfortable. And But that's not good enough, is it? Because we are not seeing the representation of non-white colleagues, people of different ethnicities, in more senior clinical roles. And so that's just wrong. It's wrong on an individual basis, but it's wrong for our organization because we are missing out on the opportunity of the amazing experience, having worked probably in two other health systems before coming to Liverpool, for people who are really experienced in their clinical function, but also have been in significant leadership roles, that we should keep them on a band five or a band six. Shouldn't just talk about grades, but you know, that denotes that we're not taking them seriously. And so, you know, we as an organization are actively looking at, and so how can we support that equitable approach for access to opportunity? I've had the privilege of receiving reverse mentoring from some members of staff, and it doesn't fill me with joy, some of the stories I hear and some of the experiences that people have. And it's, we can call it all sorts. It can be unconscious bias. We can call it all sorts, but it's prejudicial behavior of treating people differently because there is a characteristic, and that characteristic is that they are not white British people. And that makes me feel angry. It makes me feel upset, but it makes me feel, why are we doing this to purposely tie one hand behind our back from being the best organization we can do? And so whatever I can do as a leader and a visible leader in our organization, I think it is absolutely my role to do that. We talk about, you know, I've mentioned a few times about being your authentic self. I'm very open. I'm a gay man. I've been out all my career. It's hard for me to hide it, I guess, you know, but there you go. But I'm comfortable about, you know, I don't go shouting or talking endlessly about my sexuality or anything, but I'm comfortable about people knowing that sort of the whole me. Obviously there are bits that I edit. We all edit that, don't we? But people knowing who I am and my background. But I equally know that that means that when I've had some traumatic and very upsetting things that have happened in my life, that I've been able to get that support to help me through it by my work colleague. My husband died 13 years ago, very unexpectedly. And the love and support I got from the people I worked with then was amazing. And I don't think I would have got through or moved on to a different place in my life without that. I was okay to talk about that loss. If I was in a situation where I didn't feel I could be supported either because of my sexuality or my gender or my ethnic background, because people wouldn't support me, we are not getting the best out of people. And people will leave our organization, or they will just come in, do the day to day, and then leave and go home. And our patients will not get that best level of care because our staff are not being treated with respect. And so for me, that whole equitable approach is around, let's just respect one another.
Tell me a bit about Scouse School, because I've seen a bit of that online, and I love, I suppose, the cultural awareness that it brings, that connection you're obviously making with the community, the pride of being the Liverpudlian. You know, what's the impact of that? And I suppose that's you walking the talk, isn't it, of trying to be inclusive.
So this was a scheme developed by three of my colleagues. I take no part in it. I go and show up and I'll do a bit of a spiel because of an audience. But it started off for our internationally recruited nurses, and then we expanded it to anybody who was coming to work in our organization who had been recruited from overseas. And then we've done it for people who are perhaps new to Liverpool. And it's free to attend. It's on a Saturday morning, early afternoon. And we talk about the history of Liverpool, how Liverpool became Liverpool, and some of its history, some of its very proud history, but some of its history that we should acknowledge, that, you know, with Liverpool's participation in the slave trade. then we talk about some of that cultural issue around the decline of industry, and then the cultural element around music and football. And so we don't want to get all really heavy with people, but we want to get them, give them a flavour of this is where they're living. And, you know, everyone has a place in Liverpool. You know, I'll be really, really proud and say I don't follow football at all. I'm from Liverpool, but I live in Manchester. And so that's a, you know, ooh, that's a bad mark. But you can be who you want to be and who you are in Liverpool, because there's something for everybody. And then we do it, you know, the colloquialisms and the Liverpool accent can be quite strong and difficult to understand. And so we do even things like, you know, we teach them Scouse words that you'll hear when you're in the street, or Scouse words that you'll hear in the hospital or in the Aussie when they come in. And so we even do sort of like, you know, we give them different scenarios, and then we'll get three of them up and they have to do a short 2-minute skit using the words. And I thought, God, well, no, gosh, nobody is going to want to do that. It's the best bit of the day. Okay. And people are all buzzing to get another Liverpool. We're all really excited about getting up and doing it. And what it's done, it's given people a bit more of an anchor and a hook into the city. But actually, well, they are not here just to work in the hospital. They are here to be part of our community and to enrich the community as a whole. Scouse School is going to develop even further, because actually what we need to do is we need to learn more from our new colleagues about what they are bringing to Liverpool that we need to learn about that will enrich our lives. So, but it's, on the whole, it's a great day. It's a lot of laughter.
A lot of laughs.
Yeah. Thank you, Scylla. And we do mention Scylla. I love Scylla. It is a real fun day, and it also creates connections between people in the room. And we'll get over 100 people. You know, we do it every other month, and we'll get 100 people turning up. And it's great. And it's a great way for people to get connections with people that are also new into our organisation.
I love that. And it's such a world away from, dare I say, the dry induction that many people have to go through when they start any organisation.
We do the dry induction as well. Can't get away from your fire training or information governance. You got to do that. But this is something. But this is a sort of a voluntary approach, and I think we are able to do it because Liverpool has a very, very strong identity. I don't know whether it would be the same if it was Surrey School. Who knows?
Well, I don't want to get into stereotypes there, so we'll move on. So I want to touch briefly, my penultimate question is about self-care, self-leadership, self-preservation, however you want to define it. And I suppose nurses by nature are usually highly compassionate, bundles of empathy. How do you make sure you're not absorbing all that emotion?
I mean, obviously, I am a nurse. I work in a different role now. I don't provide clinical care myself. But to look after myself, I think that it's, I'll be honest, I think I've got myself into lumber in the past where I've just done more and more and more, and I'm absolutely running on an empty tank. And I've done that because I think, oh, well, I'm all right. I'm quote unquote resilient and I can bounce back. But unless you've got something in the tank, you're never going to bounce back properly. And so I'm a lot more aware now of when I perhaps need to slow down a bit, or how I make better use of my time out of work. Work is always going to be busy, but I can sometimes control my out of work, my weekends. I really try and keep my week, I live by myself, got great friends, but I really try and keep my weekend, except when I'm on call, work free. I would much rather stay later in the evening, Monday to Friday or Monday to Thursday, do a bit of catch up in the evenings at home. But my weekends is not my weekend. And it's about having time off. It's around, you know, we don't really get much opportunity. It's around doing some exercise. It's around being with people. And if you can combine the two. So I joined a walking group because I love walking, but I was doing the same old walks. And it's, I think I'm really, personally, I'm very fortunate that most of my friends don't work in the NHS. Most of my friends aren't nurses. So we don't get into the NHS politics. And the people say, how's work? And you know what? They talk about it at length, but they wouldn't understand. And it would be a bit pointless because they're going to talk about whatever it is they do. And I'll just go, lovely. Or I'll do something sympathetic. So we check in with each other, but actually it's having something different going on in my life. And in the main, I get that right.
I often talk about nurturing your network and being really intentional with who you surround yourself with so that you do get variety in whatever shape or form that might be. And yes, that sounds like that's how you've been approaching it. Yeah. Fantastic. So my final question is, what's the one piece of advice you would give someone who's perhaps has been in that specialist role looking to move into a broader executive role for the first time?
I think there's a couple of pieces of advice. I think one of them is make yourself known. One of the things that I have is that I have people just sending me an email saying, I'm in such and such a role. I don't know what I want to do next. And you know what? It's an opportunity for me to have a cup of coffee and a biscuit, and we'll have a cup of coffee and a biscuit. And we'll just talk about, so where are they at the career? What's the bit that's really interesting them? And you know, I'm doing that all day long, but yeah, I do it frequently enough for me to be able to better understand that. And then people making themselves known is really important. People, put yourselves out there. If you see that there's an initiative happening in your organization that even just sparks a little bit of interest, make yourself known that actually you might want to be part of that, or you might want to have a peripheral role in it, or it might be that you use some of your own time, but that might be really rewarding to you personally, because it might give you the direction of, that's really not what I want to do, you know, because it's equally important to understand what your next role isn't going to be.
Yeah Try before you buy, kind of thing.
Yeah, indeed. I was in my previous roles, I was a deputy chief executive, which was great and really interesting, as well as chief nurse. And then I was the interim chief executive for a while. And I knew that being a chief executive was one thing I never want to be. Not that it's not a great job, but it doesn't push the buttons I need in my career and my life to satisfy me. It's the same as a nurse. Thinking about what clinical area you want to work in when you first qualify. Always thought I wanted to work in accidents and emergency departments. And then I did it as a student and I thought, there's no way I want to work here. It's not like the telly. It wasn't like the television at all, surprisingly. And then I found my own niche when I qualified. And you know what? Even if you go into something, it's not going to be forever, or it doesn't have to be forever, but you will take something from it to move into your next role.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. I literally could talk to you forever, but we do have to end at some point. People want to get in touch or follow you, like where's the best way?
The best approach is to go through Twitter, X.
Yeah.
And my handle is @ David F. Melia. That's F for Freddie.
And I'll put that all in the show notes. Well, thank you very much again for your time.
No, thank you very much for the opportunity. It's been really great.
If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts and let me know what you thought on LinkedIn. You can find me at Lee Griffith. I'll be back with the next episode in 2 weeks' time. So in the meantime, sign up to my newsletter at sundayskies.com for monthly insights on how else you can lead with impact. Until next time.